The life of Jesus is always full of the extraordinary, always full of the things that surprise and can amaze us. And today we're going to be sitting with one of those miracles and one of those realities. And it's, for John, it's the first miracle, turning water into wine. And it's one that I'm not sure that we always quite know what to do with because it's so far out of our experience. But yet we're met with it all the same. So hear the words of John from chapter 2, and this is verses 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples also had been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, standing there were six stone jars, water jars, for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, those servants who had drawn the water knew. The steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you've kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. They have no wine. They have no wine. They have no wine. You can imagine that being whispered underneath the party music as the dancing continues. The party was loud and underway, but the prospect of running dry was here and frankly unthinkable. And this is a big deal. In a culture where even pagans found it necessary to identify their god in charge of drink and festivities, think Dionysus and Bacchus here, the person to look after the wine, which was the only safe thing to drink, it's a big deal to come up dry. But even bigger still is the fact that this is a wedding. And that weddings are these moments of social import where the wheels are greased and family honor is in full display. And if you don't get it right, they're going to be whispering for quite some time. All this in a culture where marriage and the giving in marriage was the social grease that moved many wheels. So they have no wine meant far more than just the state of their store cupboard at the end. When you run out of wine, you run out of honor, of capability, of presence, and you're hitting rock bottom. Now, I begin here not just to geek out on the classics in Roman history and ancient Near East wedding traditions, though I could at length, but we'll skip that today. I think this is one of these miracles that we don't quite know what to do with because it's so far out of our range of experience. Healing and the sight, giving sight to the blind, we at least have a frame of reference for that. We know people who have been restored. We know that people can see. But having one thing turn into another magically, this sounds like, you know, Harry Potter. And nothing else. And that's if we even manage to get past our notion of a teetotaling God. And can God really have anything to do with blind? We come to this skeptically and to the wedding of Cana, trying to make sense of what John is doing outside of just driving home the fact that Jesus is God in one more way. He just told us that Jesus is God repeatedly over and over and over in chapter 1. And now here's what Jesus God does in chapter 2. It can all be a bit heady to consider, and we don't always know what to do with this because it's so far out of our experience. It says, I'm not sure that it is. I'm not sure that it really is, because if we step back from literally turning water into wine, and I've never seen that before, we do know something about the root feeling of what is going on here. We know what it is to run out of wine. We know what it is to run out a little bit dry from time to time. We may well even be run out of wine right now if it comes to that. Coming to the point where the tank is empty and the energy by which life is lived is somehow out of place and diminished, we all have that moment. And while we may not live in a culture with the same expectations of honor and hospitality as that of the ancient Near East, it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to capture the anxiousness of the moment and the hopelessness it can cause. We can see the embarrassment, we can see the lack, we can see the dryness. And what's more, I think we probably even know it pretty well ourselves. January is a cruel month. When my life was ruled by the academic calendar, I often found myself right about now coming to the point of pretty near desperation. The weeks before had been full of promise and difference because, hey, I survived exams. I got all my papers done from last term. I can go hang out and travel for a couple of weeks, and then I get to come back and swap stories of what you did and get a new term started, and all of this is good. But round about now, I finally got around to reading all the syllabi that they handed out in the first week, and I've come to the conclusion that I am catastrophically in trouble. And that there's no way in God's green earth that I'm going to get all this done. So, having concluded that I'm about to be hit by a train, I settled down for a couple of days of panic before getting on with work. That's January. Throw in for bonus that the fact that where I attended college and seminary in Elkhart County, Indiana, basically has cloud cover from November to March, nonstop, it's a little bit bleak. I think we all know what it is to run out of wine. And we may well be out of wine right about now. The new year is worn in, and all the specialties of the last have been tucked away for the year. And now we're left to the ordinary life without the expectation of the extraordinary coming into it. During Advent and the high seasons, we are readily presented with the story of God's movement, causing us to be attuned and expect God with us. We live the stories of faith yet again and are all but reciting aloud the familiar words of Luke, recounting the days of Caesar Augustus. But now the party is over, and we come down from the mountaintop, and we're left with now what? And the question is asked, where do we look for God with us in the ordinariness of life, in the routines of our world and reality? Where do we know God when we are out of wine? Where do we look when we ourselves are drained? I think the answer to these questions is deceptively simple. Where do we look? We look to God, and we look and we expect it even when we don't anticipate it. I think this is what we can glean from this miracle. Yes, John is telling us about Jesus and offering evidence of who he is and what he does, but he's also talking about the nature of God, the nature of how God works. God comes into this ordinary situation of an ordinary wedding. As I said, no small affair of a couple hours of catering and baby pictures and white cake, but rather, three or four days of carnival for the whole town to come out and party. And that's where the wine comes in. This is no mere violation of the Martha Stewart protocol, as I said, but it is ordinary. It is there. And Jesus and God act even in this place. But what it takes is a little bit of expectation. It takes Jesus' mother to pull him by the sleeve and say, son, they have no wine. And we can all but see Jesus rolling his eyes as he says, mother, what has that to do with me? My hour doesn't come. But Mary knows. Mary knows who and what Jesus is and is inviting Jesus to own that identity for himself. Moreover, it's a leap of faith that Jesus and also God has a remedy for even this situation. That God might show up even here. That God might come and care about this. And that makes a huge difference. Most of our miracles that we look for are the big gestures of God that apply not only that apply in the big situations. But what Mary is suggesting here is that God applies not only to angels and magi, but also to the day-to-day as well. Mary looks for the way of God and expects to find it and is not disappointed. Jesus uses ordinary miracles of an ordinary household, the water of everyday living in the vessels of everyday piety, and through this does something extraordinary and visits the world-altering power of God into a situation where it's simply not expected and is most surprised. The ordinary realities are brought into contact with the hand of God, and the routine is transformed not just into wine, but the finest wine that has yet been served. God breaks in and provides the wine, provides what is needed, when it is needed, and how it is needed. It's done in grace where it's least expected. I think that's the point here. I think that we are offered the opportunity to look for God even when we don't necessarily expect to be filled. I wonder, how much of God do we miss simply because we expect that God be up here and not down here with the rest of us? Often we are faced with situations and circumstances that seem so far desperate and so far out of anyone's control that we don't particularly expect to have God show up along the way. You know, it's just the ordinary stuff and the ordinary things that we might not even bother to even, you know, pray about because, well, God knows what's on our to-do list. Why should we repeat ourselves? Yet, the promise of God with us is the promise that God comes and is with us even in the blah ordinary things of life. And when we stop expecting God along the way, we can miss God entirely. The promise of the intoxicating high points of faith is not so much that we might celebrate to the point that we would be held over to the next spiritual peak, but rather that we would learn at the high points that God continues with us all the way down the mountain and all the way through the valley and back out the other side, giving us the wine along the way, even when we find ourselves dry. God's care and the entire quality of our reality is changed and are changed with the potential of the holy if we are open to the holy. God is with us and dwells among us, and the waters of our lives have changed. The routines of life and the commonness of casual contact and simple acts of kindness are not just the ordinary things that they once were, but rather become opportunities for the world-altering and mind-changing intervention of God's grace and God's presence to flow into our reality. Oftentimes, it takes an expectation that God might even be here, even in the places that we would struggle to find God. But also to take time, even in the most desperate moments, to slow down long enough to say, I am looking for you, God. I am welcoming you, God. And expecting you, God. And to be open to that surprise on the way. God has come into the world. And the waters of reality are changed, offering even more than what is expected, even in the driest areas of our lives. We are called to live our lives, tasting the water of ordinariness, all the time anticipating, even on the most basic level, that we might, something that we may not have tasted before. The inbreaking of God's love and God's grace all the way along the way, and the wine that buoys the celebration in good times and bad. We are called to live, not just to live in the ordinariness of our life in anticipation of something else, but rather as a continuation of the reality that we know to be most true, the celebration of God's life and life-giving action in the world. God gives us what we need, even when we are left feeling that little else but a want of refreshment. May our waters be forever changed and forever sustained with the sweetness of the God whose provision surpasses every expectation that we hold. And may we have a palate tuned to taste the wine of God's presence, even in the most ordinary days of our lives. Amen.